You ever notice how many things are named Saint so-and-so? A lot of churches have those names. Also schools, colleges, hospitals. There's even whole cities that bear the name of some saint. And many of these titles come from a group of men in the New Testament, some of whom we know more about than others. They were the ones closest to Jesus during his life and ministry here on earth. They're sometimes called the disciples. Sometimes they're known as the apostles. Sometimes simply the 12. Now, we just read it a few minutes ago, but without cheating, without looking at your Bibles, how many of them do you think you could rattle off the top of your head? There's some of the really familiar ones, Simon, Peter, James, John. Some of you might remember Andrew or Philip. There's Doubting Thomas, right? And don't forget Judas Iscariot. He was the traitor of the bunch. But in addition to knowing these men as Saint Peter or Saint John, we also have this image from medieval art that biblical characters walked around with halos over their heads. And they had these facial expressions that are just unnatural. You just don't see people looking like that the way they're depicted in art or in stained glass windows. I mean, who really looks like that? And you add all of these up and we get the impression that the people of the Bible aren't really real. They're made up of plastic or cardboard or something. Hence, we can't really relate to them. But is that accurate? These people in the Bible, specifically these 12 that walked with Jesus and went with him everywhere he went, were they real people? We call them disciples or apostles. Do we even know what that means? Now, we don't have the time here to go into an in-depth study of each of the 12. We may do that at another time. It is a fascinating study. But I'd like to take a look at some lessons we can learn today by considering them as a group. Now, all three of the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, record this incident where Jesus selected them, set them apart as the 12. Each of the texts bring insight to us. We read earlier from Luke chapter 6, and that's really where we're going to spend our time. But I'd like to read the other two just to give you a little different angle on this same event. Matthew chapter 10 verses 2 through 4 adds, these are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and his brother Andrew. James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John. Philip and Bartholomew. Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector. James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. And then you see in Mark chapter 3, verses 13 through 19, Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him, and he appointed 12, designating them apostles, that they may be with him, and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. And then he goes on and lists the same 12 that Matthew did. Now I want you to consider, just very briefly, something about the listing of these names in these passages. There's minor variations in order, but if you divide them into groups of four, the first name in each of those groups is always the same. And it's likely that there may have been divisions within the 12. Matthew pairs them. And we are told later that at one point Jesus sent them out in pairs. Maybe these were the pairings as they went out. We don't know. So we have here a group of 12. And you really find more focus on them as a group than you do individually. You might expect that Simon Peter's name appears most in the New Testament, about 210 times. If you take all of the other references by name to the other 11, it comes out to 142. So Peter was very much the most known, most well-known of the group. Some of these men we know very little except their names. Now, in church history, we do have some evidences of what they did after the New Testament story concludes, but some of that is even speculation. The first name on the list is Simon. We know him better as Peter. That word Peter means rock. Now, if you'll notice, not only is he mentioned first in the list, Matthew even uses the word first. First of all, Simon Peter. And that probably means first among equals. He was the spokesman. He was the leader. And throughout the life of Jesus and then even into the book of Acts, you often see Peter as the spokesman. He's the outspoken one. He's the one venturing an opinion or giving an answer. Not always the right one, but he was always there and had something to say. You'll notice within the group are two sets of brothers, Simon, Peter, and Andrew, and then James and John, but there may be a third pairing. We notice that Matthew is listed, and we talked about him last week. His other name was Levi, and he's known as the son of Alphaeus. Well, if you look in the list, there's also a James, the son of Alphaeus. And if those two fathers were the same man, then Matthew and this James would have been brothers as well. There may have also been a father-son pair in the 12. In the King James Version of Luke and Acts, there's a disciple that's called Judas, the brother of James. But that is an incorrect translation. The Greek literally says Judas of James. And whenever you see that in the Greek, it means the son of, not the brother of. You say, well, why would they put brother in there? And it has to do with the identification of the authors of two letters later in the New Testament, James and Jude. Church history has come to realize that they were half-brothers of Jesus. They were the children of Mary and Joseph after Jesus was born. But the Roman Catholic Church could never accept that Mary had children. And so they had to explain away how James and Jude could have been not the offspring of Mary and Joseph, and so they tried to make them brothers rather than Judas, the son of James, and they suggest that the two apostles wrote those letters rather than two brothers of our Lord. In fact, this is Judas, the son of James. In the other lists, he's called Thaddeus, so Jude Thaddeus was his full name, and it's very likely since they don't qualify who this James is, he may have been the son of James, the brother of John. So a lot of family connections here within the 12. Now, among all of that, once we get through all of those things, we come to realize some important truths about the group, about them as a collection. These were men of very ordinary character. Leon Morris observes, when Jesus chose his 12, he did not choose supermen. God does not need outstanding people to do his work. And it seems that while some of the 12 were very able men, others were very ordinary. John MacArthur, in his book entitled 12 Ordinary Men, adds, he seems to have deliberately chosen men who were notable only for their ordinariness. I think he made up a word there. These were just ordinary men. They weren't from highly influential or wealthy backgrounds. None of them that we know of were exceptionally talented or well-educated. In fact, we read in Acts 4:3, when the Jewish religious leaders saw the courage of Peter and John and realized they were unschooled, ordinary men, they took note that they had been with Jesus. There wasn't anything outstanding about these guys that would think, oh, well, they were just born with that talent. No, they had to explain it some other way. And so they realized it's because they had spent time with Jesus. In fact, there were people you would not expect to have been chosen by Jesus. I think two of the most interesting characters to consider in this group are Matthew, the tax collector, and Simon, the one they call the zealot. Matthew, being a tax collector, meant he was collaborating with Rome before he came to Jesus. The zealots, that's not a word we use a whole lot today, but it was actually the title of a group back in the first century Judea. They were the radicals. They were the extremists. I think if I were translating the Gospels today into English that we understand, I would not call him Simon the Zealot. I would call him Simon the Terrorist. You get an idea of who we're talking about here. And as William Barclay adds, if outside of Jesus, if Simon the Zealot had come across Matthew, he probably would have slit his throat. But when Jesus comes, he transforms these people and brings them into a grouping to where you have people working hand in hand together, calling each other brother, who outside the church you would think couldn't stand to look at each other. That's what Jesus does. He doesn't call people that are all the same into his family. He calls different people. Vastly different people. And very ordinary people. Now you might wonder why. Why would Jesus call these ordinary guys? Run-of-the-mill, blue-collar workers? You know, we think of the fishermen. They were like factory workers. They were blue-collar guys. You know, maybe Matthew, we would say today, was an accountant. But nothing particularly special, nothing outstanding about them. Why? Well, if you go through Scripture, you'll notice God has a habit of doing this. He loves to choose people that are least likely to succeed and use them to accomplish his purpose. Why would he do that? Paul gives us the answer in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 through 31. He writes, "Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things, even the things that aren't. So to nullify the things that are," here's the answer, "so that no one may boast before him." That's why Jesus chooses ordinary guys. That's why God chooses ordinary people like us. So that nobody can stand before God and say, "Look what I did for you." We can't even brag to other people about, "Look what we've done." That would be like people walking next door and seeing the beautiful work that's being done and giving me credit for it. A couple of you have seen me paint. You know I didn't do that. I can't take credit for that. All I can say is we've got some very talented and hardworking people here, and I thank God for them, because if it was up to me, it wouldn't look half as good as it does. God chooses ordinary people so that he gets the credit. I often think of Samson. Remember Samson? Strong guy, did these superhuman feats. People today probably think he looked like the Incredible Hulk with really long hair, right? 20 years ago, if we had cast this movie, we would have gotten Arnold Schwarzenegger to play Samson. I really think Samson looked like me with really long hair. I think he was very ordinary. Trust me, if he looked like he was all hyped out on steroids, people would say, "Wow, look at his muscles." No, they're scratching their heads saying, "How could he do that? How could this little pencil neck geek pull off this amazing feat?" Because it was God who did it. And God still works that way today. He wants ordinary people. Meaning, he wants you. Don't ever excuse yourself by saying, "Well, I can't do anything for God. He'll have to get somebody more qualified than me." Do you know what the qualification is to be used by God? If you can fog up a mirror, that's it. If you're breathing and your heart's beating, God can use you. And in fact, he wants to. You are precisely the kind of person He wants to use. You don't have to have any super abilities. When Jesus chose these 12, it's as though He said, give me 12 ordinary men and I will change the world. And He did just that. See, the work of Jesus is not in the hands of men that the world calls great, but in the hands of ordinary people like ourselves. I want you to notice, though, that Jesus did not select these 12 at random. He didn't line up a whole bunch of people and say, okay, number off, and whoever gets a certain number, you come follow me. In fact, He spent a whole night in prayer beforehand to make sure He got it right. And there is something you'll notice. There's a common thread among the 12. These were men with an overall commitment. And I think you see this in the term disciple. That's the word we probably associate most with the 12. They were the 12 disciples. And that sounds so holy. That sounds so religious. And frankly, most people don't have a clue what it means. What do we mean by disciple? Well, it's a translation of a Greek word that you would know and it wouldn't matter if you did. But it means a learner. It means a student. Someone who follows another's teaching. But in the first century, there was something a little more than just going to a class or getting online and downloading their lecture. To be a disciple meant that you literally followed the master everywhere he went. I think a good idea or concept to get the picture of a disciple in those days is the word apprentice. Now, you know what an apprentice is, right? An apprentice is somebody who starts off knowing nothing, but they learn from a master. And we usually think of an apprentice not so much in a classroom setting, but as a vocational or learning a skill. Now, for some reason, whenever I hear apprentice, I always think of a blacksmith. I don't know why. But you think of the master blacksmith, and the apprentice is there, and he watches. And as he's watching the blacksmith work, the blacksmith will explain, okay, this is why we do this, this is how we do this, and he shows him step by step the whole process. A little later on, he'll say, okay, I want you to come and do this one step in the process. You help me with this. Master's still doing it all, but he gets him involved a little bit more, until finally the apprentice does the whole thing with the master watching. Make sure that he doesn't burn himself or burn the shop down. And eventually, the apprentice is able to do it on his own. That's what a disciple was in those days. And that's precisely what these 12 were to do. They were to follow Jesus, literally. They walked with Him. They ate with Him. They slept with Him. Everywhere Jesus went, they went. And they observed. And for a long time, they only observed. But then Jesus got them to do. We're going to see later that He sent them out on preaching missions or on evangelistic missions with Jesus' oversight. Because Jesus knew that one day He would be gone and they would have to carry on the work. So a disciple is one who learns by doing. This isn't a book smart education. This isn't a classroom. They learn by doing. And as we've seen in the lives of Peter and Andrew, James and John and Matthew, the call to be a disciple meant you left everything behind. This is an overall life-changing commitment. They left their families, they left their occupations, they left their possessions. This was a commitment of their whole life, not just a little bit of time or a little bit of money. This was something they committed themselves to totally. And they learned together. Now, we do see many times Jesus addresses the crowds, but oftentimes Jesus is simply teaching His disciples. He taught them things that the crowds didn't hear. This was a very intensive training. They were His apprentices. Now, I do want to point out that this word disciple is used of people beyond the 12. Okay, there's one point where Jesus sent out 72 in pairs to do the ministry. In the book of Acts, the word was used to describe all Christians. And I firmly believe if you're going to be a Christian, you are going to be a disciple. I don't think you can separate the two. Now, I know some preachers and teachers do. You know, you get saved, you're a Christian, but if you really want to live for God, you can be a disciple. I don't know how you can be a Christian and not live for God. I don't think Christ gives that option. I'll be your Savior, but not your Lord. He says, follow me. If you're going to trust me, I want you to follow me. Now, while Jesus had many disciples, we see that he handpicked this small group of men to whom he would entrust the ministry when he was gone. These were men with an outstanding challenge. And we see this in the word apostle. I used to think disciple and apostle was just interchangeable, meant the same thing. They don't. Very different words, very different meanings, and very different functions. Now, why, we might ask, why did he choose 12? And I agree with a number of commentators who conclude that this is the number of the tribes of Israel. But it indicates that Jesus is establishing the true Israel, the people of God. Now, I want you to notice, did not say new Israel. I don't believe that Jesus was starting over and replacing the Israel of the Old Testament with the church of the new. I never believe that. Because these were all Jewish people. All 12 of these were Jews. 11 of them were Galileans, and Judas Iscariot was the only Judean for all that we know. But these were Jews. Jesus himself was a Jew. All of the early Christians were Jews. But what set them apart is they were true Jews. These were the ones who were not Jewish because they had the DNA of Abraham somewhere in their background. These are Jews because they had faith in God. It's what Paul writes in Romans 2, verses 28 and 29. A true Jew isn't one outwardly. Circumcision isn't physical. A true Jew is a Jew of the heart. One who believes. One who trusts God. And this is what Jesus was doing. But I do believe that the 12 apostles do relate to the 12 tribes. I used to think maybe each apostle came out of a different tribe, but that can't be because several of them were brothers. So that can't be the case. But I think the number is significant for that reason. Now we read in Luke 6:13, Jesus called his disciples, chose 12 of them, whom he designated apostles. So from the many disciples, he chose 12 apostles. Not only are they committed followers, they are also commissioned representatives. And that's what the word apostle means. Now the English word apostle actually comes directly from the Greek. It's not a translation, it's a transliteration. The Greek word is apostolos. They just shortened it and said apostle. What that meant in those days was one sent forth. Like a messenger. If I had an official message that I had to send, I would entrust it to somebody and they would deliver that message. But in the ancient world, it meant even more than a mere courier. It was used to indicate someone who was authorized to represent the one who sent them. And I think the best word in our usage, a concept we still have to this day, is the idea of an ambassador. Think of an ambassador. They are officially qualified to speak for their government in the land of another. They have the authority. They've been authorized. And that's what an apostle is. Now, in New Testament times, an apostle was commissioned for official service by one with authority. And as I said earlier, Jesus had many disciples. He only had 12 apostles. These were his special ambassadors. Now, if you look at Jesus' last words on earth, as recorded by Matthew, the Great Commission, go into all the world and make disciples. Before that, there's a phrase that we often leave out, and we shouldn't, because it's very important. Verse 18 says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, Jesus is speaking. Therefore, you go. There's the authorization. Jesus has the right to authorize these men to represent Him because He has authority. And He delegates that authority to His apostles. So you see, an apostle then is like an ambassador today. It's a title of great respect and privilege, but also a great responsibility. One interesting sidelight. Who is the first person to appear on the scene as an apostle? And we would obviously think Simon Peter. That's not the case. According to the New Testament, it is Jesus Himself. We don't usually think of Jesus as being an apostle. But Hebrews 3:1 says, Jesus, the apostle and high priest of whom we confess. Because Jesus came with the authority of the Father. And many times in the Gospels He'll say, I'm only saying what the Father wants me to say. Jesus was God the Father's ambassador to earth. And now that Jesus has gone back to be with the Father, He has authorized us as His ambassadors. One resource I saw this last week, I think, gave a helpful distinction between disciples and apostles. A disciple is one who learns. An apostle is one who is sent. A disciple receives a message. An apostle transmits a message. There were many disciples, there were few apostles. We must know before we can tell, but we need to tell what we know. Learning is the basis for living. A changed life is the fruit of learning. Jesus needs disciples before He can have apostles, but Jesus wants to make apostles out of His disciples. And then it ends with a quote from Jesus, John 20, verse 21, as the Father has sent me, so send I you. Even as Jesus was authorized from the Father to speak for Him on earth, so Jesus has sent us with that same commission, that same authority. We represent the King. We represent God to people here on earth. See, Paul picked up this theme in 2 Corinthians 5:20. He says, we are therefore Christ's ambassadors. He uses the word. As though God were making His appeal through us. That's what the apostles were. They were given a message and they were said, told to go and deliver that message. We are His official spokesman to a lost and dying world. Think of the church as heaven's embassy on earth, and we are Christ's ambassadors. Warren Wiersbe concludes, the work of salvation could be accomplished only by Jesus Christ, and He did it alone. But the witness of this salvation could only be accomplished by His people, those who have trusted Him and been saved. The King needed ambassadors to carry His message, and He still needs them. It is not enough that we pray for laborers to be sent into the harvest fields. We must make ourselves available to serve Him. Now, I doubt that any of us are ever going to have a church or a school or let alone a city named after us. But we're all saints, according to the Scriptures. We are all called out from among the rest of the world. And we are given a special mission to represent the King. Now, can you imagine if an ambassador for the United States was serving in another country and he gets a special message from the White House and he says, I want you to go to the head of that nation where you're living and deliver this message. The ambassador reads the message and says, I don't feel like it. How long do you think he's going to remain an ambassador? Not long. Oh, I don't know if I like this message. You know, that head of state, they might not like it. They might not like me. He might kick me out. I don't know if I can risk that. That's not your choice. When you're ambassador, you do what you're told, and you speak what you've been given. The Great Commission is a command. It's not the Great Suggestion. We are told to go and to tell people about Jesus. Because quite frankly, folks, if we're not telling people about Jesus, there's no point for this church to exist. That's why we're here. Now, the fellowship is great, and I appreciate our fellowship. But trust me, we're going to have greater fellowship when we all get to heaven, right? And we look forward to that. Now, we need the fellowship here on earth. The Bible commands us to go to church so that we can encourage one another, to build one another up. We're commanded to do it. But that's not the only reason we're here. We're not only here for each other. We are here for each other, but that's not all. We have a commission. We have a message that needs to get out. Why? Because people are lost. People are dying. People are headed to hell. And we are the only things stopping them. Think about that. Imagine that you wake up in the middle of the night. Maybe you're like me and the dogs have to be let out. And as you're standing at your doorway, you look across the street and the house across the street is on fire. Fully engulfed. And you know there are people in that house. And if you sit there and say, wow, I hope the fire department gets here soon, and you do nothing, what does that say about you? Now, I'm not saying you sprint across and bust in the door and save them. That'd be great if you could. But even picking up the phone and dialing 911, even at 3:30 in the morning, you can remember that. You're doing something to save those people's lives. Could you imagine standing there and saying, boy, it's 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning. They probably really don't want a phone call about now. They probably don't want somebody to wake them up. You know, what if it's not really a fire? Maybe I'm just seeing things. We come up with all kinds of excuses. And you think, that's ridiculous. Nobody would ever do that. We do it every day. Because there are people we encounter who are lost. And I'm not just saying random people out there we don't know. I'm talking about people you already know. If you don't know anybody in your life that is not a part of this church, you need to get out more. We need to be in the world. We need to be in contact with people. But it's not enough just to say, well, they'll see my life and then they'll come to God. No, they got to hear it too. Now, I'm convinced they got to see Him first. But they got to hear it at some point. We are Christ's ambassadors as though God were making His appeal through us because there is no other way. God is not going to send angels to do our job. God is not going to write it in the clouds. Read John 3:16. I don't think people today would know what that meant. It's up to us. You know, those 12 men that Jesus chose, they were very ordinary. And I imagine people that day probably looked at that ragtag bunch and thought, are you kidding me? That group's going to change the world? Especially if they hung around them for any period of time. You know, they're arguing about which one's the greatest and, you know, this, that, and the other. Very ordinary people, and yet they changed the world because they were people of an overall commitment. They gave their all, and they rose up to that outstanding challenge, and they met it. I know it's been said before, but it needs repeating. Every church is one generation away from extinction. If we don't do what we're called to do, the doors of this church, the doors of every other church are going to close. It's up to us to get the word out. Nobody else is going to do it. And if anything is proven by the 12 that we see here this morning, it's that God can use anybody. Trust me, if He could use them, He can use you. The only thing He requires is that you be willing. Are you?